Welcome to Hallel Fellowship on the internet at hallel.info. The Noahide covenant in Genesis 9 verses 1 through 17 establishes God's promise to never again destroy the earth, foreshadowing the fulfillment of the Genesis 3 verse 15 promise to Eve. This study explores how that covenant emphasizes the sanctity of life, the prohibition on bloodshed, and the command to swarm the earth, meaning to repopulate it. Those themes are woven throughout the Abrahamic covenant revealed in Genesis 12, 15, 22, and 26. Crucially, the covenant addresses humanity's yetzer hara, the Hebrew term for the evil inclination or fallenness since Eden. That's opposed to a common philosophy today that humanity is fundamentally tov, the Hebrew word for good. The antidote for yetzer hara is yetzer ha-tov, the good inclination. That's made possible by following the Spirit of God's guidance in taking captive our thoughts and bring them into submission to the heaven's word, embodied in Yeshua the Messiah or Jesus the Christ. The Messiah's work, foreshadowed by Noah's Ark, reconciles and restores us from our yetzer hara as heaven plans for humanity to emerge into a new heavens and a new earth in the Messianic era.
Covenant, the Noah covenant, and specifically about the exiting of the ark, and about this exiting of the ark is about the exiting from the protection of the ark, because one of the things that is present there in the flood is that the Noah and the family and all the animals that he was told to go in and enter, they had to go into the ark for safety. So one of the things, and you'll see this in the passage that we take a look at in Peter's letters, where he's comparing the talking about the ark and Noah and the days of Noah as about the saving from the days to come or the day of the Lord. So the ark has been seen down through time as a figure for the kingdom of God in general and the Mashiach in particular. So, one of the things that we've talked about in our Galatians study, which is coming in for a conclusion, is why it is that not just the death, you know, we might focus a lot about Pesach, Passover, and the death of the Messiah, but also the resurrection and the ascension are so important. Why? Because humanity has to exit the Teva or exit the Ark at some point. There is going to be the restoration. One of the things we celebrate on the Shemini Atzeret or the eighth day, the eighth day of after the beginning of the Feast of Tabernacles, is that it is a new beginning. And why is that seen as a new beginning? Because you've first starting with the day of blowing trumpets, that is seen as a wake-up call for the world. Then you have the day of atonement, that's seen as a judgment seat for the world. Then you have the days of tabernacles, Sukkot, and that is seen as here, the dwelling place of God is with mankind, as is recorded there in Revelation 21 and 22, and you see hints of that also in the prophets in passages like Zechariah 14, that the dwelling place of God is going to be with mankind. Well, one of the things that you see Sukkot through the end of that, so the Feast of Tabernacles at the end of it, the bookend on the end of Sukkot is this Shemini Atzeret, the eighth day. And the number eight is very important in, you could say, Bible patterns, because, you know, we think of the numbers that are very significant in the Bible, seven being a number, and what do you see seven related to? Completion. And it's very interesting because we get a couple of different Hebrew words that are associated with seven. You see, the seventh day, or Shavi'i, we get oath from that. Shavah in Hebrew is oath. So it's very interesting points that you see in creation. You come up to 7 days, that is completed. The world is created and completed. So the word seven itself becomes synonymous with oath, meaning that if you take an oath, you as a person, you had better do what? Keep it completed. Bring it to completion. See it through to the end. So that is the important part that you as a human need to be doing. Now, why is that? Because heaven also has made promises. Heaven has been involved with a Shiva, one after the other after the other. There is a promise that's being brought forward, a promise. So if heaven keeps promises, then we also on earth keep promises. You see it throughout the Torah and also in the Psalms that you should what? Your vows, because vows are also a form of a promise. Keep them. Keep your vows. And what does Messiah say in the Gospels about oaths? That if there's any doubt that you won't bring something to completion, you should do what? Just say yes or no. Don't start making promises, or what is it? The various aphorisms, don't write checks, what? That you can't cash. So that is with an oath, a promise, that if you cannot see it through to completion, you had better not even enter that. So don't start stacking these promises on top of just where a simple yes or no. And then when you say yes or no, you should do what? Mean it. Where the old aphorism goes, a man's word is his what? Bond. And what is important about bonds in construction, right? They always worry about projects being bonded. Well, what does that mean? And contractors being bonded. Is what do the bonding companies do? If you can't perform, the bonding company comes in and sure, they'll get it done. They will get it done one way or another. They will bring it into for a completion. So that's when, what heaven is saying with the oath, with a Shiva. If you are saying and stacking and bringing, and when you look in the Gospels, that's in particular what's talking about. If you are bringing God in as your bonding company, so to speak, what are you really trying to rope heaven into doing for you? So thus, seven became an important thing of saying, hey, if you say it's going to be done, it will be done. Well, seven, even the name itself, seven, oath, eight, and we talk about this in the time of Shemini Atzeret, the word shemen means, literally it means like fat or flowing over or something. So thus the idea is that something has reached the top and is going over the sides. So thus you get the picture that comes from that as being, it is a new beginning. It's reached the top, it's seven, it's gone to Shiva, and now it's shemen. It's now gone over and beyond that. So thus the picture of the eighth day is that something, you've reached the dwelling place of God, and then what is going over the top of that? Now, the dwelling place of God is with mankind for how long? Forever. Le'olam va'ed, to the horizon, over the top, beyond where you can see, and on. So thus, that is where it's flown over and is now gone into eternity with that. So when we get back to this picture of the ark here, and that you are reaching the end of where you were in the ark, and now you are leaving the ark. You've been saved through the deluge, and now you must leave. To use another biblical illustration for this, Israel is freed from the house of bondage. And then what happens? lots of stuff happened, but if you were to just skip, hit the fast forward button of the Exodus, there's the mountain. Okay, you get to meet the mountain. Well, then what? Where's the ultimate destination? The promised land. To enter the Lord's rest. That is the ultimate destination. So, you've got to go all the way up where? To the border. That's reaching the completion point. You then go into the land. Okay, but then as you go on through Israel's history, what happens when Israel gets into the land? There's people there already, right? Yeah. So then you actually then have to flow over into the land. And it's interesting that the wording here for that we have in Genesis chapter 8 about the coming out of the ark is they were to exit the Teva and then swarm across the earth. And it's the same word that's used for like a locust swarm. So that's all humanity is to swarm over the earth. So the idea is that you don't just stay put in one place, you flow out. And then that's where we see as Genesis continues is where the problem comes in, is that you see that you stay put in one place. And you don't swarm out into all the earth. And then that poses a problem, as we'll see as we continue on through Genesis, that if you don't continue to swarm out into all the earth, then you start having problems of people wanting to then what? Dominate those who are confined into a particular space. And we have this particular figure we'll be meeting soon, Nimrod, who wants to become a hunter of people. And we'll see how that goes. But the idea that the Lord actually has to go through and confuse the languages to get people to swarm the earth, to move, get moving. Move out to actually take care of what you're doing. Because you see a similar thing that happens later on in the history of the Bible with the coming into the land is that Israel did not do what in all of the land? Israel did not swarm across the land. They left Philistia there. They left it. And then it became what? A thorn in the side. They left it, and it's a thorn to the side to this day because Israel did not swarm the land. It didn't swarm to the edges of what? The edges of the hills? We'll be seeing here soon about where those edges were. All the when the Lord said, hey, Abraham, do what? Walk. Walk across. Walk this way, walk that way. Why? Just to get your steps in for the day or the month? No. It's about where the people of God are treading. That becomes what? The territory for the people of God across the land. But you're asking about the swarming the whole earth. But just talking about the when you get the instruction from the Lord to go out and swarm across the earth, do you just stay put in one place? Because why? That's it becomes more convenient than to go out and start new places, to go into new frontiers. By you'll see later on as we see through Israel's history that not dealing with Philistia was easier, wasn't it? Because Philistia posed a significant problem. Yes, Rose, you have a comment or a question?
Go over the Caucasus Mountains and begin to infiltrate into Eastern and Europe?
Yeah, did they do that on their own volition? No.
I'm sure that...
No, they were dragged off and largely forgot who they were. So this wasn't like a, say, okay, we are tasked with going to swarm the earth. No, they were dragged away from, and especially the northern tribes. They had nearly forgotten who they were even before they were dragged away, and then quickly forgot who they were and got lost and assimilated largely into the nations, where it's, you know, people do lots of sleuthing to various degrees of accuracy to find where all these people went. Why? Because they didn't keep who they were. They did not keep the legacy. Or God knew who they were. But one of the things that you see, it's very similar to what you see the Apostle Paul talk about in Romans chapter 1. They did not take the knowledge of God as something to be what? Retained, guarded, protected, perpetuated from one generation to the other. So then what happened? They became like everybody else. So thus it's extremely difficult. I mean, you can do genetic research and maybe find traces of them. But even if you do find traces of them, what legacy of the kingdom of God have you actually found? People that are genetically related? I mean, there's lots of people that are genetically related to the kingdom of God, but we have an instruction from the herald of the Messiah about that very topic. But people who claim to be descendants of Abraham, and what was the herald's reply to that? That he can make descendants of Abraham out of what? Rocks. Because why? And as we'll see a little later on here when we start talking about this Noah covenant, that it is important to be about what? Trust and hear and do. That is what makes a part of the covenant that you're in. So that is what is extremely important. And that's like when you see in Romans where Paul talks about in chapters 9 through 11, his illustration of the olive tree and natural branches on, wild branches grafted on, natural branches pruned off, grafted back on. What is the whole point of that? Horticulture? No. It's about, do you want to stay in the tree? The wild branches, they're being drawn by the creator of heaven and earth. Where? To become a part of the tree, to be part of the kingdom of God. The ones that are naturally on the tree may not see that they want to stay on the tree or understand what the whole tree is all about, you know. They're on an olive tree and they think they're on a grapefruit tree and end up producing either no fruit or something else. So, yeah, this actually, I was at a wine conference here this week, and that was a big topic of grafting over, because right now there's a whole lot of Zinfandel sitting on the vine. There's a whole lot of Cabernet Sauvignon sitting on the vine. There's a whole lot of Pinot Noir sitting on the vine. Why? No one wants it. Yeah. Either no one wants it or they won't pay what you farmed it at. So, yeah, your farming cost on it is costing the equivalent of probably going about for Napa Valley Cabernet Sauvignon. You're pushing about $5,000 to $10,000 a ton on it, depending on where it is. So that means to stay in business, you need to be getting what? More than that. Problem is that the going rate for Cabernet Sauvignon in, if you have no contracts in Napa Valley, $2,500 a ton. Ouch. Ouches. 2 years ago, it was $10,000 a ton. So, thus, you have a lot of grape growers that are thinking about what? What's selling right now? And right now, it's Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc. So then what? They're thinking about, starting to graft them over. to put something else in. But that's not just a simple procedure. I mean, it takes a while. It takes several years to get it back over into something else. And then the ground could shift under your feet. So taking this analogy back over from the world of horticulture into the world of people in the spiritual realm, then what? If you are not bearing fruit or bearing the fruit that's just not in demand, you might get snipped off. And the vineyard manager may say, okay, well, it's time to graft this over into something else, and something else will get grafted onto it. So thus, there's a lot of caution that is going from these brokers of grapes and wine in bulk sitting in winery tanks saying, just be careful about being a little bit too hasty in your movement on it. But it's a good lesson for the spiritual realm as to, hey, you may be producing something where there is no demand for it. Or, you know, to put it in different terms that you'll see in the Gospels, hey, didn't we do this? And didn't we do that? And what does the master say? I didn't know you. So great, you did stuff, but who are you? Did you remain in the vine? Something that you see the Messiah pray for. So when we talk about this topic that we're here in Genesis chapter 8 and 9 here, that, and this is a thing that's come up and ever you see discussions about the flood and such, because there is a whole lot of language, especially we saw it in last session, we were going through the beginning part of the flood, and it says, what? All of the earth was covered. All of the mountains were covered. All of this was covered. All of that was covered. So one of the things that you'll see a lot of critics of the Bible will say is, hey, they'll see some instances in the Bible where all doesn't mean all. It's has come to be called like the divine hyperbole, of where you'll see all being referred to is, and when you see the context of it, is all who care, all who are, you know, connected to God, or all who don't care, all who are not connected to God, but the all doesn't encompass everybody and everything. However, then when you see these accounts of the flood, one of the things that's very different from those other places in the Bible where you see things where the word kol in Hebrew, which is translated all or everything, is referring to actually specifically everything and all, is where you see redundant mentions of it. And that's exactly where you see it. We see it in our passage here today, where they're coming out of the ark. And this covenant, this deal, this promise that heaven is making with everything that's coming out of the ark is a parallel to what you saw before they went into the ark, is all, coal, all of it is involved. So this is something that happened to everything on the planet. Now, why is that important? Because we'll see as we get moving on further that you'll see the Apostle Peter is saying, hey, people just think everything is going to go on as it is. And we'll see that as we move on. And it goes into the promise that you see in the covenant that was given to Noah. The covenant is that what? Seed time and harvest, day and night. These things will continue on as they are. Well, if this was just a flood that happened in Mesopotamia, what do the people of China care? Or in Africa? Or North America? What do they care about a flood in Mesopotamia, if that's all it was? You'll see a lot of, quote, history programs that will talk about this. Oh, it was just a local flood, a little deluge here, something like that. You even see some caricatures made of this on TV programs about this. And they'll think, oh, well, it was just a local flood. Well, like we were talking about last time, you'll see massive amounts of damage to large parts of the planet. And you see evidence of this in the Grand Canyon with all the layers stacked up like a pancake going across hundreds of miles, the same dirt, the same layers over hundreds and hundreds of miles. So this wasn't a local flood by any means. So thus, when you're seeing about a judgment that came across the entire earth, and the warning is, hey, this happened before to the entire earth. There's going to be another judgment that's coming. It's not going to be happening over in Timbuktu or in Daejeon, Korea, or somewhere else. No. It'll be the whole planet. So thus, when you see the return of the Son of Man, the warning is, hey, it's not going to be out there somewhere. You're not going to get, you know, a text message, you know, your phone is not going to go beep, 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 beep. You know, yeah, like with an earthquake or a tsunami or whatever that, hey, it's coming. No, you're not going to need to get some warning from somewhere because it will be something that is revealed to the entire planet. So that is where coal, all the earth, everything, it's going to apply again. As it was before, as it will be again. So that's a warning. That's just saying we'll be seeing that soon. So we see here in the particular passage in Genesis 8, verses 20 and 22, where it talks about this altar being set up. And it's setting up a very interesting thing, because we'll see it a lot when you see in the book of Leviticus or Vayikra, because it talks about they built an altar. And very specific, they built an altar, and then they offered up some of the clean animals that had been specifically brought on board for the purpose, but that it was a soothing aroma. The Lord smelled a soothing aroma. Well, we mentioned this when we were in Leviticus. I don't know, you may have had the unpleasant opportunity to smell burnt hair, burnt flesh. Yeah, that is not soothing. So that's telling you, hey, there's something else that's being communicated here besides some aesthetic. You know, this isn't like some sort of sensory description here. You're not buying a fine wine or, you know, some nice bouquet of flowers where it's telling you what you're going to expect when you smell it. Now, this is looking under the hood, so to speak, of what is going on here. That this going up is going to be a soothing aroma. Now, think about it. You know, we all have either considered so-called prepping, done prepping ourselves, watched programs, even you'll see popular media talking about prepping, or people who didn't prep in some sort of disaster or such, and the aftermath of it, of not having prepped. What is always the concern about? Running out of this or that. Running out, not having enough, you didn't get the right stuff, and this and that and the other. So when you think about the Tevat, the ark, what was on it? Coal, all of it. Coal is it's the Hebrew word coal, so which means all or everything. All that was on the planet. Yeah, yeah. It probably ended up with coal sometime after the flood, but as far as what was on the boat itself. So if you're offering up, now you start thinking about people decades ago did the math about how many animals and such were on the ark there. You know, and you'll see the caricature people will talk about, well, there's no way that you could get 2 to 10 million species on the planet onto the ark. Like we talked about last week, that's not what bara mean means. Bara mean, or created from, otherwise known as kind, means. Some people say it's those things that are, you could say, a family of animals or people. And with families, you work together and you can have offspring. And that's kind of considered what level you're talking about. Now that can go up, and people have said maybe up as like at the what they saw in the taxonomy levels of like family. Maybe it's even up to genus, but it is not species, subspecies and such like that, where you're into the millions of them. If you take things up even further, you're talking about into maximum about 100 some odd thousand that you'd be talking about of possible Bataramine. But even from that, what was in the ocean, bugs, which a large portion of that, et cetera. So when you talk about land animals, that have the nefesh chayim, or the breath of life in them, you got a small little subset of that that can get into the ark. But still, that's coal. That's all there is. And now you're going to do what with it? Offer it up and smoke? So, I mean, just think about this. If you take it into your prepping idea, you know, maybe you're really adventurous. You've got 5 pallets of food. And take one of those pallets and send it up in smoke. Wow. When you talk about sacrifice, you're thinking, ay, 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 ay. Well, thus, what it is that you are seeing is one of the core parts of what a zebach or a offering is. And when you get into Leviticus, you'll see what that is. You are offering what is the most important part of what you're offering there? Yourself. Trust. You're trusting. So you yourself are trusting. You are offering yourself up. And that's when you see the word that's used most often in Vayikra for offering. It is karban, meaning the thing that approaches. So what does it approach? Yeah, it's an animal or your grain or your drink offering or whatever. That, yes, that is approaching. But who sent it? People. People sent it forward. And like we've talked about in the time of Yom Kippur, this in the past cycle, that if you are bringing the karban, that thing which is to approach, but the person bringing it doesn't want to approach and go all the way to the presence of God, what good and what is the reception that heaven gives to that offering? Thus, you see passages like in Psalm 51, sacrifice is not desired. You see passages like Isaiah 1, I hate your festivals. You see that kind of language. You see, like Isaiah 58, this is not the kind of fast I wanted. Because why? You're not bringing yourself. Yourself is not actually approaching via the way that heaven said to approach. So with this back to Genesis 8 and this soothing aroma that's going up, the Lord was saying here in Genesis 8:21. The Lord said to himself, and he said, Levi, he said in his heart. So that's what it's translated, said to himself. He said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. Will never again destroy every living thing that I have done. Never again curse the ground. So never again curse the ground. So, does that mean that the Genesis 3 curse is now lifted? Woohoo! All right. We can just kick back and let the sheaves just grow by themselves. You don't have to do any sort of plowing, nothing. No, don't have to take care of that anymore. So is that what it's talking about? The ground is no longer cursed. But you see also, why was the ground cursed in Genesis 3? That was about what? They had option A, door number one, door number two, or tree number one, tree number two. And they picked tree number two. But life was in tree number one, or door number one. So since you went through door number two, that's like, okay, dying, you will die, almost figure it out yourself. But by the mercy of God, you won't have to just be figuring it all out yourself and be left on your own. Thus, it's going to take a lot of work. Stuff is not going to just grow for you anymore. But it says there in particular, the intent of man's heart, or the Hebrew word there is yetzer. So yetzer is where we get the yetzer hara, or the evil inclination, the evil desire, yetzer hatov, which is what? The good inclination. So thus we are stuck here with this kind of conundrum. The yetzer hara, or the evil inclination, or the yetzer hatov, the good inclination. One of the things that is then a good question, when the Bible is saying all his yetzer is only ra or bad or evil continually, well, that is then a challenge of the so-called noble savage, the so-called everybody being a blank slate when they come aboard. Well, wait a minute. If then only the yetzer is ra, or the inclination is evil or bad from the beginning, that is what? It's a statement of Genesis chapter 3. It's a statement of reality. Humanity went through door number 2, tree number 2, the tree of the knowledge of good and bad, or tov and ra. Since they chose that, then what is your yetzer, or your inclination, your desires going to be for? Because you've gone down that road, you're already gone in the door. So thus, what? You are now working from humanity's inclinations are toward what? Ra, bad. And that is where you see kind of a challenge that comes in when you see a Bible approach to society and life versus the, you know, we are like the Rousseau, the noble savage who everybody is just a blank slate when they're born. Yeah, right. You know that you fight that from the moment you're born, of just wanting to do things for yourself. Now, you could say, well, that's not such a bad thing. If you are going to the struggle to survive, wouldn't you just want to survive and get everything for yourself? Well, that can be, when you talk about the survival instinct, okay, great. But then where are you then informed, then your knowledge of tov and ra, of good and bad, that hey, your grab everything you have so that you live, that can easily move over into the raw or the bad category. So that's what is the thing that we all learn from when we were younger? That we have to take what captive? Those thoughts that we have, mine, 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 mine. We have to take that captive. And do what? Put it under submission to what? Came to be known as the Golden Rule, recorded there in Leviticus 19:18. That, hey, you don't hold a grudge against your neighbor, but you do what? You love your neighbor. And it says earlier that you seek the good for your neighbor. And if your neighbor is headed off the path, you know, you're not trying to lord it over him, but you say, hey, that you're headed down a bad path, turn around. So thus we see that, yes, that description that we have here in Genesis chapter 8 is indeed absolutely correct. That is what has happened from the very beginning of time, that the inclination of man is only ra, bad. Starts from that, and you have to be what? Educated, informed, to give some sort of thing, a filter for your brain to choose. Because one of the things, what was one of the experiments that came with the AI revolution? Come up with these things, they're machine learning, large language models, etc., which are just mainly a free association. And one of the things that you do with free association or brainstorming, everything just pops in your head. They're like, the people that try to do things with brainstorming, they say, what? No idea is wrong. Just put everything up there. Anything that just pops in your head, put it up there on the board. That is a lot of what AI works on, is free association of things. And it can get to accurate ideas, just like a brainstorming session for people getting together can come up with great ideas. But what do you need to do with those ideas? Every little thing that pops into your head. Take them captive. You have to put them to some sort of standard, a filter through that. And that was one of the earlier iterations when they just let the chatbots go wild on the internet, and they were coming up with reprehensible stuff. Because all the free associations of this, all ideas and possibilities out there, was not ever brought to some sort of filter. And they have to keep taking the thing offline, adding more filters, putting it back. Oh, crud. And then, you know, because why? It was just working with all the stuff that's out there. And there's lots of yetzer hara, or the evil inclination that's out there, the bad inclinations out there. And with no filter on anything, what are you supposed to weigh that against? You know, one of the things that is coming to start getting reined in is that trend of gentle parenting, where, you know, you had some friends who would always tell me, no, don't ever say to him, no, don't ever say no. Just divert their attention, do something like this, whatever. Well, as that kid grew up, it was just became more and more and more just unruly. And, you know, now he's like in college and yeah. So that's a similar thing that they're starting to hear more and more about on a larger society level, of where this idea of gentle parenting, or basically parents back off and not really provide kids with the kinds of filters, with the Torah, with the morals of society. And you see a similar thing that happened with the New Atheist movement. New Atheists are coasting on the influence of the Bible and the culture. It's about probably 50 to 75 years of just coasting, where you've had more and more of the Bible being pulled out of society and everyday life. And so you have the New Atheists are just coasting on that leadership that was there. But then when you could say, when your car runs out of the energy to keep moving it forward and fight against friction and everything else that's slowing it down and making it stop, well, then it stops. That old laws of motion. Object in motion will tend to stay in motion, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the problem is why? Society runs out of moral gas, so to speak. It doesn't have that push anymore of moving it forward. So thus you now see the same New Atheists who said, get God out, get it out of the schools, get it, we don't want to see it, just we don't see it in the civics areas, we don't want to see it in public spaces, nothing. Now they're like, oh, you know, I really liked it when that cathedral was there, but now it's like a bookstore. Or that cathedral is now like a yoga spa. Or, you know, that we used to hear carols and now we just hear stuff and hatred and stuff like that. So the same person is saying, we don't want to hear it, is now like, oh, I like hearing it. Because why? Those guardrails that they fought against, they realized you actually needed the guardrails to be there in place. So, which gets us to this idea of, in chapter 9 of Genesis, of the Noahide covenant. Be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. So, the question that people have raised over a couple hundred years, you know, chief one of those is Malthus. Well, it's like, it was Malthus actually correct that the earth has reached its fullness? You got all that multiplying and filling is already done. So when you start adding any more people, you're doing what? Overpopulating. So was Malthus right? Is that be fruitful and multiply until you get up to a certain limit, and then you have to do what? Reduce the excess population by whatever means you possibly can? Yeah, just drive through Nevada. There's a whole lot of places on the earth that are just empty, whole large parts of it. Because what happens over time? The same things that we'll see happen after the flood. People congregate together. Now, getting together is not a bad thing. To have families, have society, getting together to collectively accomplish things, not a bad sort of thing. But what happens if the same thing, your Yetzer Hara, the evil incarnation, is not ever reined in or given a lot of filter, and you don't pay attention to the evil inclination, the evil desires to rein those in with something, and you get in with a whole bunch of other people? What do you see? What takes over? People become afraid of their neighbors, afraid. I mean, look at what's going on with when you see the pullback of law enforcement in a lot of major cities right now. They're afraid to go out because of all kinds of things that are happening now. So now there's a push to what? Bring more law enforcement back in. So that's what you call the necessary evil, because yes, the violence, the predation of one person upon another, just like we saw in that passage here today, one of the instructions post-flood, that if someone is going to take someone's life, you're going after the image of God. So then what? You have to then answer that. And we start seeing as the Torah goes on, how that answering the loss of life on one side, the shedding of blood, how that gets answered as a society together, and how you actually deal with those people to stop that kind of thing from going on without going completely overboard in the same process. It's a struggle that goes on. But it is interesting that in Genesis 9, verses 2 and 3, it talks about, with everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea, and into your hand they are giving. Every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. I give all to you as I gave the green plant. Okay, there's that coal thing. I give all, going to Kohl's and picking up dinner. But no, it's this, when it's talking about all, it's something we'll get to in just a moment. But first, it's talking about everything that creeps on the ground, all the fish of the sea, into your hand they are given. And then you see it moves on later and talks about that the fear of what? The fear of mankind, the fear of, as it says, Ha-Adam, or fear of the man, fear of humanity will be in all flesh. Well, how very interesting that just here recently, there was a study that was published in, where was this? Current Biology. So in the 2023, it was a study that was done in by Western University, and it was down in South Africa in the Greater Kruger National Park. And what they did was they did like over 4,000 trials of where they played recordings of various types, just various sound recordings of voices of birds and animals and such for control. But they also mixed in their voices of people into this. And they were finding that animals were twice as likely to run away and abandon the water holes 40% of the time when they heard a human voice. So they're playing all kinds of different voices, but just when a human voice popped up, and they were specifically looking for animals and birds and such that didn't have regular contact with people on a regular basis. So it wasn't like, you know, the hunters or poachers were after them all the time, so thus they were afraid. It's like, well, is this because of their environment, because of the predation or the poaching? Or is this something else that's just naturally built in? And wow, lo and behold, Lo and behold, yes, it is something that is imprinted into life forms, that they are afraid of the sound of people. Wonder where that came from. Strange. But you see, as it's moving on through this Noahide promise, that's in Genesis 9:4, only you shall not eat the flesh with its life, that is, its blood. Well, that's a very interesting thing. Where have we heard that before? Not eat things with the blood in it. We're going to encounter that as we get into the rest of the Torah itself. But where's the other place that we've seen that? Acts chapter 15, remember? Or some of the instructions that were given to these believers that were coming in from the nations, i.e. non-Jewish, who were said, okay, we'll just give you four things to avoid when you come in, and the eating of blood was one of those. Yeah, I think that was a specialty. Well, you know, when you see it persisting on various cultures, both in North America and all over the world, that the eating of blood has, you know, not only survival sorts of reasons for it, but also spiritual reasons that are brought in for it, both here in North America and all over the world. And the idea of drinking the blood of an animal, whether it be a sacrificial animal or just your subsistence animal that you are killing for food, just generally, that's the drinking of blood is a part of what? Connecting with the animal that it is that you're killing. But one of those things that you'll see, and this is not just any particular culture here in North America, happens across the planet, and you'll see in a number of the various cults that you cross paths with in the Bible, that yes, the drinking of blood, it's a Canaanite thing that was going on. Egyptians thought that was gross, but the Canaanites, you'll see those sorts of things going on. You'll see it happen in the Far East, all different parts of the planet. You'll see this connection. The Germanic tribes, where the drinking of blood is associated with the life and participating in the life of the animal and in the greater life of the planets or the various deities that you're appealing to. So then what was the big deal with these new believers coming in? To say, no. Immorality, drinking of blood, things that are strangled. Why is it that you have these things? Well, one of the things that we had seen when we were going through our Roman study before we got to Galatians is that these things that are mentioned there in Acts chapter 15 were common practices that were done in various Greek and other mystery cults, etc., of the time period where Paul and the apostles were writing and dealing with. So we'll see, like when you get into the Torah, like in passages in the first chapters of Deuteronomy, where there is the specific instructions, do not pick up the practices of the peoples that you're going in amongst. You know, if they are interested in celestial objects, don't go after those sorts of things. Don't pick up these practices and say, hey, we'll worship the Lord like that. Don't set up an Asherah pole next to the altar. Don't mix these things together. Why is that? Be holy, be separate, be separated from, a distinction from, and just saying, hey, there's something that is other, and then there's something that is set apart and leads you toward a closer connection with the creator of heaven and earth. Defiling a holy place? Yeah, because what is the defiling of the holy place? Like, for example, we've got Hanukkah coming up here, and that's a celebration of what? The restoration, the reconsecration of the temple, which was defiled because of what? They were bringing pigs in and various things, and thus were doing on the holy place and in the temple there in Jerusalem, So thus, you are then bringing in those things of the nations, the gods of the nations, and just mixing them up because you're doing it right there in this place. So thus, the message, just strictly speaking, the message, if you're saying that some of what is going on in a congregation that is set aside looks and is a lot like congregations that are not set aside or practices to some other deity, what would people then think? Well, those practices involving the deities must be okay because you've imported those things in and have now made them a part of the belief system. I mean, one of the things that you'll see archaeologists do is kind of sneering at the Bible as they will dig up in Israel. They found these like wall creches that were basically sort of a facsimile. Probably people were doing it on some sort of description. Maybe they saw it. The temple in Jerusalem, Solomon's temple, because they are kind of styled after the two pillars there. So it sort of looks like that, but it then has a little idol in it. And usually it's a male and a female. And on some of them, they found one that says, for the Lod, and it's Yod-Heh-Wav-Heh and his Asherah. So thus you'll see these archaeologists will go, well, wait a minute here. We found this. So what is the Bible telling us about? Now, you keep all that stuff out. You keep the Asherah poles out. They're like, well, the Bible's full of it because we actually found ourselves. We found this thing here that says, the Lod and his Asherah. Well, that must be the way the things really are. Well, the thing though is that the Bible tells us why it is that the archaeologists found that there. It's because what was going on was rampant in Israel after the going into the land. They didn't swarm the land when they went in after the Exodus. They didn't swarm the land. So then what happened? The stuff was just left there. The pockets of different practices and this and that, and it just started, even though the warnings were there throughout Deuteronomy for that second generation that was going to go into the land, don't mix this stuff. Don't look at their practices, say, hey, that looks cool, let's bring that in. Don't do that. Because why? It creates spiritual confusion in there. Because you'll get confused after a while of what the distinctions are between the things that are set aside, that are holy, set aside, and the things that are common. You'll start losing that sort of distinction and just blur them all the lines together. Like the golden calf. That's a great example in the various practices that bring these various things in. So you should always be looking at that as to say, well, what are we bringing in and importing in? Because, yeah, those practices exactly. And like another one that you'll see some archaeologists will get on is like circumcision. The Egyptians did that. You'll even see some in Mesopotamia, some examples of that. Well, then, I mean, isn't it this practice didn't originate with Abraham and such like that? So then it must not really mean much of anything at all. Well, what is the point of where you have the circumcision there? That when we talk about a covenant, it is an about Abraham and where his sons were coming from, where his promised son was going to come from, and then where all of their descendants and his Sarah, his seed, was going to come from and what it would become. That's one of the big lessons in there, which is very interesting and gets us into a discussion as we go on here further, because we've been just finished up the letter to Galatians. And one of the things that we've seen as far as a lesson of what Paul is getting at with his railing against circumcision is, and especially connecting that to Abraham and the Abrahamic covenant, again, another barit, was that when was Abraham declared a tzaddik, righteous? When was he declared that? Before circumcision or after circumcision? Before. So thus, the point is that you do not consider this to be a ticket into the kingdom by thus the things of the flesh, because that is what the oath of circumcision is about. The sign of circumcision is about what? God did this through Sarai, changed her to Sarah, because she would then become what? The queen, the one who would be the line, and it would be through her. It wouldn't be through Hagar or anybody else that this promise, that the seed, the Zarah, was going to pass through. It was not going to pass through any of them. It was going to come through Sarah. Oh, yes, Carrie, go ahead, please.
I think one of my thoughts about circumcision, too, is that it's a sign of the belief of the parents, because it's an act. I mean, the baby isn't, I mean, all they know is pain. They don't know what it's for or anything like that. So it's actually, I mean, adult circumcision is something completely different, but the original one is really about the belief of the parents.
Yes. That they are starting the child down this particular road. So we move on here further in Genesis chapter 9, and more of where it says, surely I will, and it's in verses 5 through 7, surely I will require your lifeblood. From every beast I will require it, and from every man, from every man's brother, I will require the life of a man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God, he made man. And as for you, be fruitful and multiply and populate the earth abundantly and multiply in it. So what are some of the key reasons for this, you could say, the beginning part of the eye for an eye, proportionality of it? Mankind is created how? In the image of God. Okay, there you go. Number one. So you're saying that's in this image of God. So it is God started out, formed Adam from the ground, breathed the breath of life into him, then specifically from him, then created Hava or Eve. So fingerprints of God there are all over the first couple, and then all of their descendants and us, since we came from all only those two. So thus, we all have bared this image of God that God is doing. That's just lineage. But also, this image of God, that you see it taking many forms of the difference between mankind, humanity, and animals and anything else. Well, what I'm here flapping my gums about right now, the ability to use language. And language, taking thoughts to language, whether it be in a talk or a teaching, whether it be prayer, whether it be supplication, you know, all kinds of forms that language is taking on. That is a huge image of God. Because what is one of the first things you see in Bereshit, in Genesis chapter 1? Yes, speaking as one of the hallmarks of God. So thus people have seen for a long time, one of the key things to say, well, did God create there? There's no evidence for it. Everywhere where you see language, there's evidence of what? A mind. Because language can only exist between two minds. Because one of the things they talk about with language is you have to have an encoder and a decoder. Right now, I am the encoder, and you are the decoder. So between us, there has to be what? You've got to have the medium. Well, in this case, it's air. So I'm, you know, vibrating air molecules by making noise in my mouth. And then it's doing what, amazingly? It's my mouth is making these movements and tongue muscles and shape of my lips and all this stuff to make words and all this stuff vibrating the air. And amazingly, you there on the other end It's bouncing off of your tympanic membrane called your eardrum. And then it's shaking bones that are connected together like levers in your ear. And then moving your inner ear in, vibrating a fluid, which is vibrating little hair molecules, hairs inside your inner ear, which are tuned to different frequencies that are then sending electrical impulses into your brain. And then that's getting decoded in the process. Well, that's just mechanics of it. Well, then what about the codex? The codex is, well, this, the language, et cetera. And there has to be an understanding of my side and your side for this to work. Now, there are a number of you are blessed to be able to, you have a number of codexes you work with, different languages you grew up with, different languages you know. So you have a number of codexes in there. So you're blessed if you can talk between yourselves and you have the same codex, you can understand each other. Or if you're a crippled American like I am, then I have to rely on like Victor over there to change my codex into your codex or one that you are more familiar with, more comfortable with. But there's all kinds of then rules and such. And that's when we get into our next Torah passage when it talks about where we talk about the Tower of Babel or confusion, that you then move from one codex that everybody understands. Suddenly God says, okay, no, I'm going to change the game here. Time to make you all swarm on the earth. So just simply change the codexes. Well, you know how, what chaos that creates, whether you're working on a job site or something like that, if you don't have inability to communicate effectively. Chaos ensues very quickly. And you can be, you know, lack of efficiency on the low end to, you know, threat to health and safety on the other if you don't get the communications that go across correctly. So that's one of the hallmarks of the image of God throughout humanity. And one of the great testimonies that you can have is, hey, there is language, and it distinguishes humanity, Ha-Adam, mankind, from any of the other things that have the breath of life in them. Because, I mean, you can talk to your dog, and the Lord has made dogs that can understand all kinds of things, but, I mean, you can't carry on long, detailed conversations with it. I mean, I suppose you could, but you may want to talk to somebody if you're having a conversation with your dog on detailed philosophy. So that's one of the things as a distinction, and one of the things that you can distinguish between something that is a bad idea, a knowledge that has led to bad things, where you say, hey, everything just came out of all that is. Even when you've got ample examples that God provides to the contrary. Yes, Rose, go ahead, please. You have long conversations with your dog.
She's the only one who listens.
The only one who listens, yes. Yeah, and, you know, that is one of the blessed things in there is that even with plants, I've done lots of research about that, about plants, even fungus, and even with fungus and their communications through their highly complex, I would call them root system, but their fiber, under the ground fiber system that they communicate with different things. It's quite amazing. And even just the sound of music or voices, et cetera, can have an amazing amount of impact in that. But yeah, even water. So they don't talk. Well, yeah, you just, yeah. Not, and it is interesting when you talk about talking back is that some people it's still kind of a bit questionable, but one of the things that some of what can come out of pattern recognition and even through artificial intelligence is the ability to take sounds and such, find patterns in them. I mean, they're doing it with astronomy. They just basically take a bunch of these pictures and sensors from the sky, run it through your AI pattern matching, and then it can find stuff that a human person may overlook because it's just trained to look for, like word association just with data. Well, similar thing is with being able to certain levels of accuracy. Again, accuracy is kind of a questionable thing, is to understand the sounds that like whales make, some of the other types of animals that show high levels of intelligence, whether they be parrots or crows or ravens, etc., to be able to take those sorts of things and turn them back into language. But again, still not with the kind of level of degree that you have with the Bible communicating to us and then ourselves back to the divine through prayer. So, when we look at the Noahide covenant itself, the parties to it, who are the parties to this covenant, the Noahide covenant? Okay, first, Elohim. Start with the basics. Elohim, then Noah, and then talks about specifically his Sarah, his seed. And then, as it talks about, Kol Nefesh HaHaya, or every living creature, the birds, the cattle, the beasts of the earth, all that comes out of the Teva, or all that came out of the Ark. So that is where all the parties to this agreement are. So, when you start seeing that people try to extrapolate this out to say you've got some other sort of rules and such for humanity out of it, you have to look back at what the actual covenant and the parties to the covenant are. That this is not just with God and mankind, here are your rules for life. No, this is with all life. Everything that went into the ark is coming out of the ark, and that is what this barit, this covenant, is with. Okay, so that is what the parties to it are. So then the covenant itself is that, there is going to be no longer any sort of karat, or cutting off of kol basar, all of the creatures. Again, there's no any sort of creating. The waters of the flood are not going to be cutting off all humanity anymore. And this one is very important, other term of the contract. It's lo yehaye od, yes, mabul. So as that goes, there'll be no longer, will be again a flood. That's the big one. And you'll see the Apostle Peter will really play on this. That is what the deal with humanity is. Okay, you can get these laws about lex talionis, eye for an eye, that from this blood for blood that you see that comes down and being a key part of the book of Leviticus or Vayikra, because that is one of the lessons with the korban, the offering that comes in, is that when you are letting out its blood, it says that the life is in the blood. That's one of the key things we get from this particular passage we're looking at in Genesis chapter 9. Life is in the blood. So thus you're seeing this instruction here that yes, the world before the flood, it was full of Hamas, violence. It was full of violence that was going to be brought forth, where people were there, and you see with Lamech in Genesis chapter 4 as talking about, and various sages debate as to whether he's boasting or whatever he's saying to his wives about killing a man, bruising a boy, etc. But the idea that this violence was there before the flood, but there wasn't a judgment. Well, the judgment came down like a flood, literally, there at the flood that covered the entire earth. So then going forward, it's like, okay, that's just not going to be tolerated anymore, where you have people just letting forth blood, even to where we see in the Torah, where if you come across a body in some secluded area, what happens? The instructions were, is all the towns in the area have to figure out who's closest, and you claim it and you basically mourn for it. You mourn for this loss of life because why? You've had the image of God has ceased to be in this particular person there here on earth. So you've got to take note of that. So that's where we get the idea of manslaughter today. Manslaughter is just the example. Someone died. And strictly speaking, that's homicide. Homicide is someone died. Now, a lot of people freak out and think, oh, homicide is someone killed him. Not necessarily. It's just someone died. And then you determine, okay, well, is there any culpability that anybody has for it? Sometimes there's just not. But you still have to take the admission someone died. Now, there's a lot of confusion in today's society where you just don't want to admit that someone dies. And thus, you have the scourge that we have with the killing of the unborn because you just will not have an admission from a lot of people that someone has died. Now, you could then have the separate discussion of, okay, culpability for it. But still, you have to admit that someone has died. Because, and I mentioned this before, but I've had conversations with my family about that, and some that just say, the ending of a life before birth, it's a happenstance that happens in life. And I say, well, okay, I know that you're really concerned about the death penalty and making sure that, you know, you don't know forever for sure, so thus do away with the death penalty. Well, can we just both admit here that someone has died, both in the death penalty case and with the abortion, that someone has died? Now, we can talk about anything else, extenuating circumstances, all that, but just at the very least, admit somebody has died. So just like with what the Torah talks about with the body that's just found somewhere, you can't just say, oh, well, and just cast it aside. The communities around the body have to say someone has died, and that's a tragedy that someone has died. So that is one of the things that we get out of the flood going forward is that, hey, you've got to start really taking responsibility for the deaths and the preservation of life, and you're not going to have the kind of violence. Well, thus you have only the inclinations of their thoughts are what? Tov? Tov always. Everybody just happy and cheery, smiles, sunshine, you know, loving, just hugging everybody. Now, we know that's only Ra continually, selfish. And we will pull back from that if we have some sort of filter that is filtering that through to say, no, we will not go with what we want to do. We will just kind of filter it through. We may still go forward with it, but at least with the idea that we have put this through to a filter. As the Apostle Paul says, you take your thoughts captive, bring them into submission to the law, the teachings of the Messiah. So when you see in this covenant here that the Lord will never again cut off by water all flesh. That cutting off is it's very interesting that you have that talking about here of the term that is used of karat, because karat is used later on when we start talking about Avraham with barit. So Avraham, karat a barit, he's cutting a covenant with the creator of heaven and earth. But in this case, you see the interesting thing is that you're saying that the Lord is making a covenant that he's not going to cut off with a flood all of heaven and earth. Now we say, okay, well, what does that really make any sort of hill of beans of difference? And the thing is that that's a very interesting look into cutting the covenant, because where do we see that actually show up again? And we see that as we move forward into Genesis 15 and forward. And Genesis 15, verse 6, is where we get the great verse that the Apostle Paul riffs on, that Abram, that he believed God. He said, amen. He said, believe God, and it was credited to him, reckoned to him as righteousness, as tzedakah. But it goes on further and then talks about this literally cutting of a covenant, this covenant where what the Lord shows up as what? Torch, a smoking furnace. And he tells Avram to do what with these animals? To what? Cut them in half and put them on separate sides. And then it says that Avram was put into a deep sleep. And this flaming torch, the smoking furnace, went through the pieces while Avram was in the deep sleep. So, a number of people have talked about these kinds of covenants and cutting the covenant, because this picture of the ceremony that's being shown there in Genesis later on with Avram and this being asleep and the torch going through the pieces, it shows up, it's been found in an 8th century BC treaty that reads, as this calf is cut to pieces, and talks about them walking through it, so this person's called Matiel will be cut to pieces. That's the ancient idea of these types of covenants and why you go through this is both parties are going through together. And you can say the idea of the suzerain vassal, the idea of the more powerful party, the vassal party, like the emperor and the vassal king going through together, parties of different powers, or you could say strengths and the relationship to each other, both going through together. They're both taking on this covenant together that we will bring this. We're making the Shiva, the oath. We will bring this to completion. Otherwise, that's going to be us cut to pieces. Whoever doesn't fulfill in the party, you know, I'm sure you find that alarming if you were looking into a contract and done under, you know, when it talks about severability, that's actually talking about really actually severing limbs off of you. That might get your attention if you're, instead of just scrolling through and hitting okay at the bottom, you actually might pay attention where it talks about losing limbs and stuff like that. But a lot of people have pointed out over the years is that the Lord goes through this alone. The presence of the Lord, they're represented with the torch and the flaming furnace, goes through the pieces alone. And thus, you see one of the important lessons that you can get from this covenant, that there with Noach, this is a deal between two parties, that the Lord is going to keep up his side. He's not going to deluge again and destroy everything. Coal, everything gone. Not going to do that again. But then humanity at the other side, what is humanity's side of it? Okay, you people with the image of God, you do not then try what? To wipe out the image of God in other people, wipe out the creatures and other stuff that are around there. You don't try to play the Shaddai destroyer and wipe out everything, just like the Lord said, I got to stop this violence here on the planet and bring this to an end and clean the slate. But this is a very important thing that when we see about this, the Lord going through the pieces by himself, as you see that one lexicon treats this with the karats used in this way in both in Genesis chapter 9 and also in Genesis 15, is that it's talking about the self-destruction of the one making the contract. And why that's important is with Abraham and the covenant that was made with him, the creator of the universe is binding himself through this theophany. Theophany is a big 50-cent word for just an appearance of the divine ritual to an unconditional promise ratified by blood. The binding is symbolized by the smoking furnace and flaming torch passing through the pieces of the slain victims. So, long story short, what does that mean? If this is not brought to a completion, which is what? The promise to Abraham of what? All the world is going to be blessed through him. And as it says later, that all of the nations are going to be blessed, there in Genesis 22. That this promise to bring the seed from the woman down through Abraham into the world, that all the world will be blessed through the seed passing through him and his seed passing it down, that if that is not brought to completion, thus you have the picture that the Lord is saying, hey, to this party, the one that's making it. And thus you can see as it gets set up for what shows up in Genesis 22, the offering of Isaac. And thus you have the picture of the instruction, offer your son, your only son, up. So this message keeps getting repeated on and on and on from one generation as it's passing through to another. The Lord has promised that he is going to bring this through to completion, that he's provided the Tava, the ark, as a place of refuge. Hear the Lord's call, get on the ark. When the deluge is passed, do what? Get off the ark and do what? Swarm the earth. And swarm it for what? For good. And so thus, when it talks about with the sign of the bow, the one who says to put the bow in the cloud of this sign of what it, he's going to look on it and remember. And we remember we touched on this when we were going at the earlier part of the flood. It wasn't that there was the Zahar and the Lord looked at, hey, there's this boat floating around there. Where'd that come from? Now, in Hebrew, the way that Zahar is used is active. So thus, when you're seeing active, like Zahar, the Shabbat, don't just say, oh yeah, look at the calendar, look at that. Oh, it came around again. No, it's like you actively keep it into mind and then do what? And we do that with the Shema. Each, you teach it to one generation after another. All throughout your day and everything that you're doing, you're taking and you're bringing this forward from one generation to the next. So that the next generation, as you see it in Deuteronomy chapter 5, they're not just remembering it, they are shamar, guarding. They're guarding the Shabbat. Because the Shabbat is another ot, a sign of an oath. It is the Shavah oath, which is kind of redundant, but it is the seven oath. That, yes, it will be done. The one who created is going to save you, take you in, redeem you from the deluge and stuff that's coming, and then take you out the other side.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L dot I-N-F-O, hallel.info.